From 1967. It's an American release of Sergio Leone for A Few Dollars More with Clint Eastwood, and that's introducing us to another episode here of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod. And we want to be talking about going after bad guys, heading for the American Southwest, just like with the bounty hunter Clint Eastwood in For A Few Dollars More. This time, however, we're looking at jihadists who might try to head into America's southern border. And so we're going to examine a new book covering America's counter-jihad covered border war here on Conservative Casual Friday, where we like to look at issues of the day for conservatives others. This new book is America's Covert Border War, the untold story of the nation's battle to prevent jihadist infiltration, from Todd Benzman, a national security fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies. A new book coming out next week, which you can pre-order online. Well, Todd Benzman, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. I like the intro music.
It's a favorite song of mine. Well, examine in this book all of the effort from your experience as a reporter in Texas and then later working for the Texas Department of Public Safety as an intelligence analyst looking at border issues there. You examine all of these efforts the United States undertakes in the United States itself as well as abroad to hinder any jihadist terrorists coming into the United States. First of all, why don't you try to explain, you have this focus in your book on what are called special interest aliens. Who are these individuals and where do they come from?
Special interest aliens. These are migrants. That's government nomenclature for migrants who are from 35 to 40 countries that are mostly Muslim majority countries where terrorist organizations operate and where extremist ideologies are very pervasive institutionally in those countries. And so the presumption is that if migrants are coming from some of those places, then they may be at a higher risk. And so they get categorized as special interest aliens when they are discovered by either Border Patrol or ICE or one of our foreign allied countries. But I have to tell you that the special interest alien term is officially not in vogue now. The Biden administration has changed it to special, let me see what that is, special interest undocumented non-citizens. That's the brand new government term for internal use for special interest aliens, because the Biden administration does not like the word alien, so they've excised it from the thing. But so when you read my book, you'll see special interest aliens, because I wrote it before the Biden administration.
Yes, these special interest aliens, or SIAs, as they're discussing your book, but I guess now with the Biden administration, we're going to have to call them special interest undocumented non-citizens. Well, I don't know. SIA is much shorter. Why don't we stick with that? Yes, the ideological proclivities of the woke Biden administration, I guess, are such that we can't call them aliens anymore, that we have to call them undocumented non-citizens. Well, you indicate that they come from mostly Muslim-majority countries. Well, how do you identify such individuals, and how do you define the countries from which they come? Is there any sort of criteria or categorization that takes place?
Yeah, there's a process that goes on in secret within the intelligence community. Now, there are 17 agencies that are members of the intelligence community. But those analysts in outfits like the CIA or the DIA and DHS, INA, they study these countries, and the process is a little bit opaque. But at the other end of the process, they will designate a country as a country of national security concern or a specially designated country of interest. They have different terms for it at different times. And if that gets on the list and a migrant comes from one of those countries on the list, then they then become special interest aliens, or sorry, whatever the new thing is. And when that happens, all kinds of activities trigger.
Well, okay. And you mentioned that many of them are from Muslim majority countries. Are there any sort of do these special interest aliens, SIAs, as we once called them, do they involve any other sort of non-jihadist related threats, any other countries that would fall on such a list and provoke such concern?
No, not really. I mean, it's all about, you know, post 9/11 counterterrorism and war on terrorism stuff. These programs that I write about, these secret, the covert border war, are probably the last unearthed, unexcavated, unexposed terrorism programs from that era. And they're still in play, very much in play. And the countries that they target, the migrants from the countries that they target, you know, there have been some that are not Muslim majority countries on the list from at various times, for example, Thailand, because it had a restive Muslim minority population in its south that was problematic in the early years after 9/11. And I believe North Korea has been on that list as well, because they were thinking spies. So that would be probably not Islamic Jihad, but, you know, India has been on the list and off the list depending. But that's because India has a very large Muslim minority that has been problematic, you know, in the Kashmir area and elsewhere. Right now, they're not on the list. And the list kind of grows and shrinks depending. During the Obama years, they tried to get rid of it entirely and called it third country nationals because there were some of the countries on that list were diplomatically, you know, kind of pissed off about being on that list, you know, because like Saudi Arabia and Egypt didn't like being listed like that. And the Obama administration kind of you know, threw a sop to them diplomatically and removed a bunch of countries from the list. But now they're back on and it goes like that. It can be politicized, but ultimately it's the intelligence community and professional career analysts that are deciding these things.
Yeah, well, interesting. You raised Saudi Arabia and Egypt raising objections. With such lists, are they then publicly known? Can then a country like Saudi Arabia's officials find out and then complain?
Well, there have been times when the list leaks out. This is part of the covert border war, that it's sort of it's infrastructure of the covert border war, the near war that I call. The lists have occasionally poked up out of the ether into the public and have gotten publicized. I've written about it in the past, and some other publications have written about and published the list. And you know, nobody wants to be on that list, and it's one of the reasons why the covert border war has remained covert for so long, is to just avoid fights like that. If they can just simply keep the whole thing kind of under wraps, they don't have to worry. They don't have to have arguments with anybody about, you know, whether they're on the list or their citizens can be considered a higher risk for committing attacks or supporting the jihad, the global jihad. But it persists and lives on to this day. Like I said, the Biden administration did not get rid of it. They just changed the nomenclature to something that doesn't have the word alien in it. But that means they're still doing it. They're still identifying migrants as special interests, something or others, and they get different treatment. It triggers security protocols and processes that are not reserved for anybody from a Spanish-speaking country, for example, coming over that border.
Yeah, you note in the book, or analyze in the book, that you have these SIAs that are coming in amidst sort of this cover of this massive flow of people from Latin America, simply coming to the United States for more maybe mundane reasons, just getting work, or for that matter, maybe say more common criminals, drug traffickers, sex traffickers, or so forth. If we talk about these SIAs and particularly the jihadist threat that they present, how has the size of this threat developed over the years? Is it growing now, or has it grown in the past, or is it decreasing now? What is the sort of magnitude and extent of what we're talking about here?
So the book, I describe the – I try to get a scope of threat out in the book the best I can, because a lot of it is still under the – behind the curtain of a classified curtain. But what we do know is from FOIA and Freedom of Information Act requests, and from other data that is public, that the numbers of SIAs who are reaching the southern border through Latin America on these smuggling routes is probably somewhere in the order of 3,000 to 4,000 a year that are apprehended just on the southern border. And then, of course, that would not account for those who got through, and nobody ever really knows how many those are. But so for just the apprehensions, and that's a pretty small number. And SIAs in and of themselves are not necessarily they were regarded as a higher risk at triggering vetting, security vetting processes. But that doesn't mean that they are terrorists necessarily. That just means that among them will be extremists, and because they have just come from those countries. The number of extremists that have been apprehended, or people who would be have reached a threshold that would really cause a 5-alarm Homeland Security fire, those are even smaller. Those numbers would be maybe a dozen to two dozen per year that are apprehended en route on the smuggling routes, on the routes, and actually at the border. And that would be via what we call derogatory intelligence reporting. Quite a few of them are already on our U.S. terror watch list, that they got listed on. They got listed somewhere down the line, maybe in their home country or by a foreign intelligence service or by our military in whatever, Afghanistan or Iraq. So that would obviously trigger five-alarm Homeland Security fire, as I put it in the book. We have bits and pieces of evidence. For example, the Panamanians last year disclosed that they have had 49 terror alerts on migrants in the last couple of years, 2017, 2018, that were on their territory coming through from South America to the U.S. border. The Mexican government last year disclosed that they had found and deported, no doubt with American involvement, 19 jihadists, and that they were never made it to the border because we have deportation operations going on in Latin America, so they never even often not don't get here. And so then we have maybe 20 terror watch listed individuals per year on average that reach the reach the U.S. border or get caught somewhere in between. So the numbers are small, but as I point out in the book, in the terrorism game, small numbers portend outsized consequences. That 19 hijackers sent America to war for 20 years in Afghanistan, for example, or my entire first chapter is dedicated to the calamity that befell Europe starting in 2015 with their mass migration crisis, which involved systematic jihadist infiltration over their borders. And perhaps maybe 150 at this point who went on to conduct really bloody suicide bombings and knife attacks and all the rest that continue to this day. Comparatively small numbers to the overall 2 million, 3 million migrants that came in that they camouflaged among, but their attacks really caused society changing consequences like Brexit and electoral outcomes that upset the post-World War II balance of power in 10 different countries over these infiltrations and military operations that were conceived specifically to stop the border infiltrations from Syria and a host of other really sort of society-changing domestic security policies and expenditures, and it just goes on and on. It's a long first chapter. So small numbers have big consequences is my point. It wouldn't take very many of these guys to really cause a lot of trouble here in the United States.
Yeah, you indicated in that chapter you analyzed, for example, the November 13th, 2015 Paris attacks, coordinated attacks on like the Bataclan theater at a rock concert and other targets like a restaurant and so forth, and how passports were found there in the wreckage of individuals, Islamic State fighters, jihadists who had used like fake Syrian documents. And that was among the various attacks in Paris and Brussels and elsewhere that involved individuals who had come into Europe. Either they were people from Europe returning or people from outside of Europe that were using this massive migrant and refugee stream to get into Europe unnoticed. Has that experience had any effect upon American policymakers? Has there been any sort of thinking or learning because of what Europe has gone through in recent years with this migrant crisis?
I think that there was during the final year of the Obama administration. I found documentation showing that J. Johnson, former Secretary of DHS, in 2016, the final year of the Obama administration, ordered up a major counter SIA initiative that involved all of the DHS component agencies. They were going to bring it all together and get on, revamp the programs that I talk about, put it in the repair shop, hoist it up, fix everything up, make sure it was that it was properly resourced and that everybody understood what the stakes were. That happened in the context of the Paris and Brussels attacks, and even more since then. They're still going on even to now, and it is very probable that that was ordered up by the Obama administration out of fear and also out of intelligence information that ISIS wanted to cross the southern border. Al-Qaeda has wanted to cross the southern border. They have found jihadists crossing all through the years after 9/11. And I think they just wanted to try to get ahead of the matter. The Trump administration, I don't think, was as actually attentive to the issue as was the Obama administration, strangely, even though it was Trump who was the first sitting president who ever came out and said that terrorists were crossing the border and that it was a major issue and that they were coming camouflaged among, you know, Spanish-speaking migrants in these big caravans. He was called a liar and there were fact checks. But the fact of the matter is that he was absolutely correct, what he was saying. And I remember his very last trip to the border was just January 12th. He went to Alamo, Texas, and stood under the wall and gave a speech. And during that speech, he said it again for about 2 minutes. He talked about how terrorists were crossing that border to an extent that most Americans would be very surprised to know, far greater than anybody has disclosed or said. And I believe that he was citing intelligence information that he had access to as president. Those last comments in January got zero attention or coverage, like none. But in any case, yeah, I think that that career Homeland Security professionals in administrations that were Republican or Democrat have maintained these programs, and they're still operating to this day. Right now, they're operating. We just had 11 Iranians hit the Arizona border last week.
Well, has America then been lucky so far and not suffering any terrorist attack from people crossing the border? Do you think that terrorist groups, jihadist groups, are going to try to target the southern border more often in the future?
Well, one of the primary theses in the book is that I am attributing the lack of attack from that quarter to these programs, to the covert border war. And I go into great detail about who we've caught, how we've caught them, and what we do with them after we catch them. And what we do with them is deport them. Most of them are deported. We have prosecuted a few in American courts. I attribute the fact that that we are better safe than sorry, is how I put it, in these deportations that the American public never knows about, never hears about, to just eliminating the problem, even the risk of the problem. When you have a guy who's got derogatory intelligence and links to Al-Qaeda, Pakistani, or six of them, as we had one time in Panama, that we deport them before they ever even get to the border. And I think that's gone a long way to keeping us safe. And that we will deport them from Mexico as well. Remember, Mexico just disclosed 19 that they deported. None of those deportations would have happened without deep American involvement, I can assure you. And we have prosecuted jihadists who have actually reached the border and got into the United States. And then, you know, we found out who they really were and prosecuted them on non-terrorism charges. But nevertheless, all of the details of their terrorist involvement are laid out in court records, which are then put in the book. And so I think that between these programs and just raw, pure luck, we have not had an attack yet on U.S. soil. We did come close. There was a Somali who came over the California border and decided not to stay in the United States, good for us, but went on up into Canada, and then in 2017 committed a double vehicle ramming attack in Edmonton that really hurt a police officer and four, you know, just regular pedestrians in that town. And he was prosecuted not for terrorism, but we, I think, dodged that bullet, and we have dodged quite a few other bullets where we've had jihadists caught in Mexico and they are hand delivered to us on the international bridges. And we bring them in and interrogate and learn who they are and very quietly deport them to other countries. And that process goes on to this day. I think we've just been lucky. But if I could just add one more thing on this, the European experience, if it taught us anything, showed that when there is mass migration that collapses our regular border management, our border control systems, that it is easier for jihadists to come through undetected, apply for asylum, which they all do, and then plot their attacks. That's what happened there. It's what's still happening. The risk is twofold for the southern border is that, A, it looks like we have another mass migration crisis brewing in Latin America, Mexico. There are a lot of predictions. I'm one of the ones who's predicting that this is happening as a result of Biden policies. And two, terrorists and criminals and bad guys in general seek to replicate past success. And Europe, if anything, to the jihadist mind, was a grand success for mobility, for the tactic of crossing borders in mass migration, camouflaged. And I lay out in the book that they are very aware that they succeeded in that way. And I think that it's very reasonable to predict that they would try to replicate that in the United States, crossing over that border. I don't think that it's outside the realm of possibility. They've tried it before. They want to. They're aspirational about it. There's good long sections in the book that describe their aspirations to cross the southern border. And these programs are not all that healthy right now either.
Yeah, well, that brings up interesting issues. You discuss in the book a lot, particularly the cooperation between the United States and Latin America, as you've indicated here, that the United States works in what you call this far war, as opposed to sort of this near war closer to the border that America tries to stop any such SIA, special interest aliens, jihadist threats. Countries far away. Thinking of the Canadian case of that Somali who engaged in the car ramming attack in 2017 in Edmonton, does Canada have any similar policies towards ideas of special interest aliens?
No, not really. The Canadians, I go into some detail about the, important differences between what goes on in Canada with our northern border and our southern border. These programs that I'm describing in the near war and the far war, which I'll describe in just a second, but those could not apply to the Canadian border or to Canada as much because, A, we have a competent, modern, collaborative partner in the Canadians, and two, and they share intelligence and are competent at what they do. I'm not saying that they catch everybody, but they catch a lot. And two, Canada does not have contiguous nations connecting to it. that provide pathways with porous borders like Latin America does to Mexico. So the geography calls for the only way that you can get into Canada as a jihadist is by air or ship, and those are fairly well controlled. You have to come in as a refugee with permission, and you can't just sneak in over Nicaragua. The Nicaraguan border, Honduran borders there. There's a third way, I suppose, they could get in is to parachute in with a dog sled team or something into the Yukon. But it's just not the same situation. And we do have people that we tag as SIAs who come into the country from Canada. And there are interviews that go on with those as well. But those people, those SIAs are far more vetted by then than anyone coming over the southern border. You have to have a refugee visa to fly into Canada by then. And there would be some, at least they'd know their name. At the very least, they'd have their name. When people show up at the southern border, they just say, my name's Mickey Mouse. They don't even have most of them don't even have passports or identification. And we don't even know if they're from the countries that they say they're from. I mean, they're total, complete strangers. You're starting at ground zero vetting these people. So the near war, if I could just take a quick second, involves essentially ICE, FBI, DIA, HS, Homeland Security Investigations, going down into the detention facilities when one is flagged, like the Iranians who just crossed in Arizona, and doing face-to-face, in-depth interviews with them, looking for signs of deception, taking their cell phones and dumping them, pocket trash, running names through databases, calling allied nations to look for looking for intelligence on these individuals from foreign intelligence services. And there's a range of investigative activities that go on before they get released, or it's supposed to happen with every one of them from those countries. And that's the near war. I describe that at length in chapter 3 and who we've caught in that way. And we have caught quite a few jihadists, people with derogatory intelligence about them. And then the other, the far war involves hunting down and dismantling the smuggling networks that bridge the Atlantic Ocean, that enable people from those countries to fly in on false documents and then to smuggle up through all of these countries to the southern border. And it's a nonstop train of migration from those countries in that way. So they're hunting the smugglers, dismantling them with allied countries and proxy armies that we have recruited in several of the countries, transit countries. And lastly, it's part of the FAR war. There's a tripwire system that's been arranged among the allied friendly countries to track down specific jihadists that have been identified as moving through and apprehending them before they get all the way to the border. And there are quite a few dramatic stories of how we have managed to lay hands on jihadists before they could get here through that tripwire system. Those are the kinds of programs that are going on right now, and they're detailed for the first time ever in the book, Covert Border War.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Sorry for the
One thing I found interesting looking at all these international efforts is you note how, these Central American countries and Mexico and so forth, they actually don't really care about people going into America in principle Mexico, for example, benefits from, something like $25 billion in remittances from people working in the United States. So these countries like Panama and so forth, they're perfectly happy to actually just transport, give free passage, as you've indicated, to people who want to get north to the United States through their country. So they, they're in principle, they're perfectly willing to not put up any barriers, to just get people on through. They'll put them on like a shuttle or something and drive them to through their country, get them up north because, they want to go to America. Okay, fine. But for these special interest aliens, they've responded to sort of American pressures to single them out. Has there ever been any controversy among Latin American countries that they are indeed sort of profiling these special interest aliens as opposed to the broad mass of people who want to go to the United States? Or has there been any attention to that issue in Latin American countries or beyond that, there really is a singling out of these people?
No, because, keep in mind that, for example, in the case of Mexico, Mexico depends on cross-border labor, the movement of cross-border labor north and the movement of remittance money south to the tune of $25, $30 billion a year, not to mention all kinds of other trade. Their economy depends on the American economy. And the Mexican position is that if a terrorist were to ever cross through its territory and conduct an attack on the United States, that the U.S. response would be economically devastating to the Mexicans. There would be border closures. There would be restrictions. There would be crackdowns. There would be significant kinds of responses. The American public would demand it, and you know how that works, right? We saw that after 9/11. There was a blank check handed to the Homeland Security agencies. And Mexico understands this. They've always understood the need to make sure that nobody comes through if they can help it, and to participate and cooperate. And the Mexicans have been somewhat cooperative, but they're also very incompetent and often indifferent as well. And I describe those problems in the book. And then there are these other countries like Panama, which is an ally, a pretty close ally, and they have no interest in allowing jihadists to pass through their territory and are more than happy to host American intelligence operations that have been there for years and years, working on this jihadist problem, and have been deporting jihadists all along for us or with us, very happy to participate. These are Catholic countries. They're not interested in seeing jihadists succeed anywhere. They know that they're not the target most of the time. I don't know, the Panama Canal might be a target, but the real issue with the countries of Latin America is, there's a couple. One is that some of them are diplomatically estranged. They're hostile to the United States. Think Cuba, which is a major transit country for SIAs. And the Cubans could care less about our security worries. Venezuela, under Chavez and Maduro, same thing. I mean, they've got close ties with the Iranians, and Hezbollah is known to operate in their territories, and they have carte blanche. Lots of Islamists hanging around in Venezuela. And Venezuela is a major SIA transit country, too. The Venezuelans are never going to help us with our security concerns. And so there are other ones. Bolivia for a long time was not that friendly toward us. And Ecuador had this weird visa-free policy where anybody from anywhere in the world could just fly in there without a visa. And so smugglers from all over the world just gravitated to Ecuador and started flying Pakistanis in by the plane load, and, Syrians and Iraqis and everybody else. And so there are these holes these gaps in the American cordon that we just can't do a whole lot about, because they're just hostile countries that don't cooperate with us. Lastly, you know, these countries of Latin America, you know, they're not Canada that's competent and has modern intelligence systems, and not trusted by the American intelligence agencies to share. And they have embassies and consulate offices in the Middle East, places like you know, Lebanon hosts a big, gigantic Mexican embassy. The Venezuelans have a big embassy in Damascus, and so do the Cubans. And Belize has embassies all over the world, and like Singapore. And what I find in the book and during my research is that the human smugglers, the SIA smugglers, very unique smugglers, are able to tap into those the corruption that's inherent in those embassies and consulates in those countries to get the travel documents that are necessary to get over the Atlantic. I dedicate a whole chapter to this problem that is really sort of undisclosed or unknown, at least up until now. So that's a mouthful. I get it.
Yeah, well, that, you know, all of this talk about these special interest aliens and these measures to really focus on them, you know, it seems to raise with me a parallel to the country-specific travel restrictions that we had under President Donald Trump, that, you know, condemned as the so-called Muslim ban. I mean, aren't these sort of just basically sort of similar policies, similar outlooks that you have to focus on specific threats, particularly with countries, as you indicated in the book, that you know, have specific problems of, say, the government doesn't exist in, say, Somalia or Libya. It's just kind of a diplomatic black hole. You can't check who's coming in from those countries. So, I mean, why is these travel restrictions so criticized? Couldn't you make an argument, say note these various programs that we're doing here for these special interest aliens, and say, look, we're just doing the same thing with these travel restrictions under Donald Trump towards these other countries?
Yeah, I mean, you make a great point there that the travel ban, I always hated the word Muslim travel ban because it's just simply inaccurate. I like accuracy. But the issue there is that those are visa restrictions. So the travel ban put restrictions on, like, you couldn't get a student visa if you were coming in from Libya, unless there was some kind of an emergency or a hardship or something that you could appeal. But there, what was never discussed about the travel ban policy was the fact that there were 13 countries, but was the fact that once that travel ban was in place, it didn't stop the workaround, which was the border, the land border, the southern land border, and migrants from all 13 of those countries just kept coming over the southern border. There was always the workaround. Syrians, you know, people from, you know, Iraq and Yemen. We have Iranians that are still coming, like I mentioned already. And just all of those countries' travel ban list were just coming in over the border. So, but nobody ever really talked about that. And I think that it was a good thing that we have had the near war that I talk about, at least to do some kind of something with those people when they cross. But even then, you can't do a security background check on a Libyan right now. And you can't do one on a Syrian. You never could do one on a Syrian. When the Syrians started crossing the southern border in 2011, 2012, and they'd never really stopped, you can't call the Assad regime. They were hostile to us, and I think we were on the other side of their war, their civil war. I mean, there was just, you don't give a phone call and say, can you tell us who this military-aged male is who showed up in San Diego. So those are real issues, and those are different issues than the vetting that would go on with the visa system. And I don't have a whole lot of any more confidence in the possibility that we can properly vet anybody coming in on a visa, a legal visa. Those people would get interviewed in a foreign consulate, maybe in Sana'a. If it's a Yemeni from coming, they'd apply and go meet with one of our officers in the capital there. But, you know, I've got a lot of examples of people from the travel ban countries pre-ban getting into terrorism investigations and prosecutions and plots and all kinds of things here, even after they were supposedly vetted for security for their visa. And they still came in with terrorism activity and history and got busted. Luckily, they got busted, but one of them didn't. There was a Syrian that went onto the campus of Ohio State pre-ban who did a vehicle ramming and stabbed some people, and there were fatalities in that thing. That never would have happened in the ban years, the travel ban years. So it's very problematic that nobody's explaining to us what the Biden administration is going to do now. And in any case, we've still got them coming over the border too. So got them coming from both ways now.
Well, yeah, as you've indicated, we've got now this new administration, Joe Biden here under president. What sort of particular dangers his policy changes might bring up with respect to America's border wars?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is his moves to expand and relax the asylum process. Because as I point out in chapter one, and we go and dedicate an entire chapter to what I call the American asylum calamity, the European catastrophe was predicated on the fact that these jihadists were coming in and claiming asylum in a backlogged system that enabled them to get inside European countries and get their weapons together and their ammo and their powder, explosive components and all that, and go kill. And that's really the issue. Like when jihadists crossed the European borders, they didn't come in with machine guns, blasting at the border patrol. They came in with a pen and signed papers and got let in on this asylum deal. And the very same process is in force here in the United States. SIAs come in, they make an asylum claim. They go through this process. They're bonded. They bond out and into the interior of the country, and that's where the big risk is. Like, we have to hope that they aren't going over to Walmart and collecting some guns or something. So what Trump did was he started to really restrict the. He did a few things. One is that he ramped up or tried to ramp up the fraud detection efforts. And then he also, for asylum fraud, which is ubiquitous among SIAs, my entire chapter is about actual jihadists who lied their way into the United States on over the border and had these coached fake asylum persecution stories that they gave that were impossible to vet. But what Trump did was he gave the asylum officers more power to actually say no on these claims. And what Biden's going to do is he's going to reverse that and make them all say yes again. Remember Mayorkas's infamous when he was head of USCIS, was do whatever you have to do to get to yes. And I really fear that, you know, that power and authority is going to be taken away to say, no, you're lying. I caught you in a lie. And the answer is no, you're going home. And so that's just one thing. And then, you know, the other thing is that, you know, the Biden administration is now seeking to expand the definitions of what asylum is. You know, what kinds of, you know, evils that people can claim that they went through to gain asylum, to gain the asylum system. And that's just never going to be good for SIAs for SIAs to be able to have more kinds of stories to claim that will get them in, and most of them unvetted, not even with identification.
Yeah, those are all significant dangers that you detail extensively in the book. How is one thing you note in the book, you've noted among sort of the political pressures that are sort of pro-immigration, open borders, that also affect the media that's often liberal-minded, that there hasn't been much attention to these dangers across the borders from jihadist threats. Have any conservative media organizations, like maybe say you might think of Fox News or something, have they analyzed this issue? Are there any sort of opportunities for them to investigate these issues and break stories here? Has this happened? Why or why not?
Well, I mean, the big problem, the initial problem for any journalist trying to get at the heart of this story is will. You have to want to do the story, and you have to see it as a story. And I think over the years, the notion of infiltration as a route, as a terrorist tactic of mobility, a mobility tactic, just is it's fraught with politics, immigration politics that about Spanish speaking migrants. So. If we all can come to an agreement on a fact set that this is an issue, that there's a threat here, and you know, something bad could happen, then you have to respond with restrictions on the camouflaging group, which would be Mexicans and Central Americans. And I think Republicans and Democrats alike, elements of both of those parties, want the cheap labor. And the Mexicans want the remittance monies, and like all of the force is on the side of open borders for this. And the truth is that, you know, a lot of American reporters, I'm not the first one to say this, are politically liberal and, you know, want to help, you know, poor migrants and the huddled masses. And there's this ideology that's associated with that. And so to report this story would mean that you would be arming the forces of restriction. And I think that reporters have avoided anything that might arm the voices of restriction with information, with facts, with truths. So I think that this, the whole issue of the threat has suffered under that. And we saw in the reaction to Donald Trump a year and a half ago when he said terrorists were coming over, the froth with which the media responded with fact checks, calling him a liar, and there are no Middle Easterners coming over. There is no migration at all from those countries, and certainly no terrorists coming across with them. And what happens is then the whole issue descends into this kind of category that sounds like, you know, fringe conspiracy land. Nobody then wants to touch it. So I think that somebody had to kind of come forward and just touch it. And I was in a unique situation in that I was a trained journalist, 23 years, who then also was an intelligence practitioner for years and years, who actually worked on the inside of this thing and saw it work, and was able to cobble together a lot of information that I hope is just the ultimate reference guide on that this particular border issue. I think that there needs to be a reference guide. There needs to be a neutral baseline of truth about this very fraught and contentious issue, border issue, and it deserves a seat at the table, in my opinion, before it's too late. I mean, why not?
Yeah, it does have a lot of interesting facts and case studies, very revealing to me, I must say. Has your book then, well, still on pre-order, coming out next week on February 16th, if I believe correctly, has your book provoked yet much interest, or your work provoked much interest? Is there hope then that this is going to make a change, have an impact?
Well, so far I've gotten quite a bit of interest. In my opinion, the work is fundamentally nonpartisan. I approach it like a journalist. I try to make it, it's the view of this threat from Homeland Security professionals who are nonpartisan. They're career people who work on this issue. This is how they see it. But I would say that regular media, traditional media, like I haven't gotten any phone calls from CNN or MSNBC or The Atlantic or The New York Times or anybody like that. So far, it seems like the interest is in the conservative press. I'm still waiting for Fox News to call me, though. But it's early. You know, the book's not quite released. I think that it just falls that way because we live in a very partisan, a very divided country right now that is unable to look at issues like this unless it's through that lens, unfortunately. And it is what it is. You know, let the book just stand as a piece of history, and hopefully, you know, security people and administration people might actually read it and implement some of its recommendations before something bad happens, like in Europe, before a Europe happens, even on a smaller scale, but certainly on the day after.
Yeah, I guess if that's what it takes to provoke a change, some sort of a jihadist outrage, as you indicate, in Europe, well, I guess at least we'll have a roadmap from you. We'll have ideas and thinking and evidence we can rely upon. So even if that's what it takes, that's something to benefit from. If you talk about these partisan divides, could this work, this issue, interest any Democrats? I mean, you've talked about how these kind of programs have existed both under George W. Bush. They were really ramped up after September 11th, and then as well under his successor, President Barack Obama, with his Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson. Would any Democrats be interested in this kind of research?
Well, you know, right now I would have to say that they're under the sway of the progressive wing of the party. It's holding a lot of sway. You can see it in the policy pronouncements and the executive orders and proclamations that are coming out. First thing out of the gate was all immigration relaxation of restrictions, and there's a whole lot more coming. And I think that people on the progressive left would probably loathe this book, would never want to open it or read it. It's anathema to Homeland Security is not like on the list of priorities for progressive people on the progressive left, unless it has to do with white supremacists. Right now, it's kind of a strange thing, it is what it is. I mean, it'll be out there for whoever needs it or wants it. But at the very least, it answers. See, I kind of felt like the country was left wanting without. Back when Trump was making these claims, for about 3 months, the media was fighting with Trump and the Trump administration over whether any of this was true. And ultimately, Trump just left off the gas on it and decided it's just not paying off. And he stopped tweeting and talking about the jihadist over the border threat. And he was called a liar repeatedly over and over again, and everything's wrong, and that sort of thing. And I think the country was left hanging in suspense over what this thing is. So at the very least, I'm just kind of hoping that the book, what the purpose of the book is to just provide that answer on that question the next time it comes up. Because every time it comes up, every time Judicial Watch comes out with a claim about, you know, terrorists crossing the border, it starts this whole thing up again. Or Duncan Hunter making claims about jihadists coming over the border, et cetera, or a Donald Trump. And I just feel like every single time it comes up, the country fights about it. And I don't think that we need to fight about it. We just need to read my book and, you know, you'll have your answers.
Yeah, I would highly recommend the book for our listeners out there. You've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to look at issues for conservatives and others. And we've been discussing here with Todd Benzman, a national security fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies, his new book coming out next week, America's Covert Border War, the Untold Story of the Nation's Battle to Prevent Jihadist Infiltration. I recommend you get your copy coming out. Well, Todd Benzman, thank you for joining us here on the show.
Great to be here, and I really do appreciate the attention. And if anybody wants to follow me or see my work, they can go to toddbenzman.com or cis.org, which is my employer.
All right, then. Excellent. Well, tune in next time for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday. Thank you very much.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.